What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Professor Itamar Rabinovich. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com. Or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. While Hurricane Sandy was pounding most of the east coast of the United States, the weather here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, has been simply beautiful. Cool, crisp early mornings giving way to warm, sunny, balmy, lovely days. There's something surreal about enjoying gorgeous fall weather while watching photos of flooding, destruction, and havoc wrought by a natural disaster on the other side of the country. It creates a true cognitive dissonance. God is giving us good conditions, and New York, New Jersey, and much of the East Coast received really bad conditions. This is both disturbing and weirdly comforting. It's impossible to view the photos of huge ocean waves and massive flooding, including the whole New York subway system, and not feel some shock and distress. 50 people dead and more, millions of people without power, some homeless, widespread damage and destruction. But in a very basic way, it's a relief to be here in a region that looks and feels even better than normal, pleasant, peaceful. It is apparently possible to feel both relieved and guilty at the same time. Frankly, that's probably a primary Jewish emotional condition. And now we have it over this hurricane. Well, the best way to help respond to this particular and peculiar emotional situation is by acting to help. After all, helping those who are most in need is a primary Jewish value, a critical form of tzedakah. You can help the recovery in two ways, by giving money or by donating blood or both. First, along with FEMA and other government agencies and authorities who are responding quickly to the disaster, as always, the Red Cross is on the scene in every state that has experienced severe damage. This will be an expensive response to help distressed people. If you can help financially, make a call to 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit their website at redcross.org or text the word Red Cross, all one word, to 90999 and you'll make an automatic $10 contribution. In addition, the Reform Jewish Movement has proved to be an excellent and efficient provider of support in emergencies. You can make a donation easily online at the URJ Hurricane Relief Fund, www.urj.org, or you can send it by mail to the Union for Reform Judaism, 633 3rd Avenue, New York, New York, 10017. Now, also, national blood supplies were adversely affected by the short-term drop in donations all along the East Coast. I mean, you can't collect blood if you can't travel and if there's no power and so on. There's information on how to give blood at redcrossblood.org. I know most of us are not on the East Coast, but that actually helps the blood supply. We've got to fill it up nationally. Giving blood helps now, too. May God provide strength and skill to all who are working to alleviate the suffering and repair the damage of Hurricane Sandy. By the way, there's a good deal of real scientific information that the huge size of this storm is related to the overall phenomenon of global warming and climate change. Why, even insurance companies now endorse that view. Who knew? Obviously, we need to continue to explore ways to lower our own carbon footprints and to work to control the greenhouse gases that are driving this destructive effect on our planet, and this week, on our own country. A central Jewish commandment is Bal Tashchit, do not destroy the earth that we've been given. It's an important motivation. On a happier note this morning, and to play us in on this beautiful fall day, here's the lovely psalm Zamru Ladonai, an Argentinian Jewish melody that's become very popular throughout the conservative movement all around the world, It was brought to the United States by Rabbi Marshall Meyer of blessed memory, the creator of the dynamic congregation B'nai Jeshurun in New York, some 30 years ago, and a guy I worked with, oh boy, a long time ago. That was Zamru Ladonai, a Hasidic melody for the psalm, popularized over the past 30 years in the conservative movement by cantors from Argentina. Our guest this morning is the outstanding academic and expert on Israel, former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Itamar Rabinovich, who will explain what Iran is really doing when we come back on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina of Mama's Pizza. This spring, Mama's Pizza was invited to be a food vendor at the Sunday night Tucson Pops concerts at Reed Park. Well, this fall, we had the honor of being invited back. I guess that even in the middle of a park, people can't resist fresh hot pizza when it's made with the best ingredients available and served at a value price. Go figure. But I gotta tell you, even after all these years, when I bite into a fresh hot slice of Mama's Pizza, I always start to hear beautiful music in my head. You see, it's not just me. I bet you hear it too. The truth is, delicious pizza, heroes, calzones, pasta, and desserts will always be music to your ears when you visit one of our four locations. Check them out at mamasfamous.com. Now you know the drill. Repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, former Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich, a renowned academic as well, and a guest about a year ago. Boker Tov, good morning.
Boker Tov and good morning.
So, even though we had you on a year ago talking about Israel and foreign relations, so much has happened in the last year. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of what seems to be an Israeli foreign policy based on red lines and in terms of dealing with Iran?
Israel's national security or foreign policy faces numerous challenges, but first and foremost among them is the Iranian challenge. It is, again, I'd use the first and foremost, the challenge of a nuclear Iran, but there's more to the Iranian challenge than just the nuclear issue. If you follow the news and see that shipment of arms, weapons, probably to Gaza, had to be destroyed in Sudan by someone, let us say, that
not that the Mossad or any Israeli or entity could be involved in such a thing.
Or the Israeli Air Force.
Or the Air Force, of course.
Yeah. Maybe it was Belgium.
Could be.
So about 2 weeks ago, a drone from Lebanon, operated apparently by either Iran or its emissaries, Hezbollah. Penetrated Israeli airspace and flew towards Dimona, where our presumed nuclear reactor is. You realize that we are looking at a regional power with huge regional ambitions that operates all over the region and presents manifold challenges. But of course, the notion of this country that whose leaders openly call for the destruction of Israel will have a nuclear weapon is the foremost challenge, and Israel has been coping with that. Now, what happened over the past year is this. President Obama certainly moved forward. He moved forward in two ways. He said expressly that containment is not a policy. The policy is prevention of Iran from becoming nuclear and not to contain nuclear Iran. And the second, he couches it now, not in terms of Israel's security, but in terms of U.S. national security. These are two positive, important developments, but in the eyes of the Israeli leadership, this and the sanctions that have been imposed on Iran simply do not suffice to stop the race. And so Israel, A, threatened to launch a strike, and eventually decided not to launch the strike before the presidential elections here in the States, but to move to the notion of putting red lines, once reached, will prompt Israel to take action.
To take military action. We will talk much more with Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Among my most pleasant and least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the total Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know anyone who might qualify for the 2012 Kohan Award, just visit our website, kohanaward.com, that's kohanaward.com, and you can find the nomination form there. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com. It's a good visit and a great place to learn about a terrific award and all the recipients.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. And now, here is our weekly 2012 presidential election campaign Jewish moment, the final one. In contrast to a recent survey of respondents in 21 countries around the world that showed they favor President Obama over Mitt Romney by a wide margin, a new opinion poll in Israel suggests that Jews in Israel would be much happier to see the Republican win. 57% of Israeli Jewish respondents said that when it comes to Israel's interests, they prefer Romney as the next U.S. president, compared to just 22% who preferred Obama. The Peace Index poll, a project of Tel Aviv University and the Independent Israel Democracy Institute, were conducted last week. Breaking down the Jewish response within Israel, among those identifying themselves as politically on the right, 70% preferred Romney, while 13% favored Obama in Israel. Among leftists, Obama led by 51-30. In the political center, Romney was favored by 54-25. U.S. support for Israel, particularly in the face of the challenges posed by Iran, has featured prominently during the U.S. election campaign, with the Jewish state mentioned about 36 times during the foreign policy debate in Florida, the last of the debates. Polls of Jews in the U.S., the ones who actually vote for the American president, continue to show support for President Obama running at 70% or so to about 23% for Mitt Romney, with 7% still on the fence. Every Democratic candidate for president since 1984 has received an outright majority of the Jewish vote, and every Democratic candidate since 1924 has outpolled his Republican opponent among Jews. But the percentage of the Jewish vote garnered by the Democratic nominee matters very much in a very close election. In 2008, Obama defeated McCain 78%-21% among Jewish voters. If Obama ends up with 70% of the Jewish vote this time around, particularly in Florida, where 6% of the voters are Jewish, and in Ohio, where only 2% of the voters are Jewish, but the race figures to be extremely close, he will likely win. If Obama drops below 70%, he will likely be in trouble. That was our campaign 2012 Jewish election moment. As they say in Chicago, vote early and vote often. We welcome Guy Gelbert, head of the Israel Center, our maven on Israel. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So last week you began to explain and did a great job explaining sort of how the Knesset works and how certain parties are promised certain ministries in the government, which means they get a staff and an office and some authority over certain stuff. Wouldn't say it's exactly protectia, bribery, but, you know, there's a certain trade-off, give and take. So the government is formed, it functions, it's going along fine. It's got 4 years to go, but somehow it never goes 4 years in Israel. What happens?
Well, there were times in the past where it did succeed in going the full 4 years. Nevertheless, there are two ways where the government can be either taken out of power or that an early elections can be defined. One can be the case where the parliament itself votes to take the government out of power.
So the Knesset has like a vote of no confidence in the government. There's some issue, the government's done something, too many people are mad, they don't want to belong to the government anymore, they vote against it.
Right, and it's need to be noted that there is no, although there are 120 members of the Knesset, the votes in any Knesset vote are only the people that are in the room.
Right.
So if there is a case where there are only 30 people of the parliament in the room and there is a vote of disconfidence in the government will fall and there will be early elections.
Just like that.
Just like that.
So you've got to make sure not only do you have the votes, but that the people are actually there.
Right. And usually the government has a person that's his job or her job to make sure.
Like in America, it's called a whip, but someone who pushes the people in.
Exactly. Right. And also sometimes, you know, if they know that the minister needs to fly out for somewhere, they will find someone from the opposition that is willing to skip the vote.
Just to balance it out.
To balance it out.
The government
stuff like that. Nevertheless, sometimes it doesn't work. Usually when somebody or one of the parties within the government feels offended by something the prime minister is doing or disagrees with the line that the government is taking, and that party might leave the coalition, might leave the government and join the opposition. In that case, the government loses its majority, and as a result, you have early elections. The other way, and that's the case in this time with Bibi, is for the prime minister himself to basically resign, come and say, I'm going to an early elections. Usually that would be done out of two reasons. Or that the prime minister feels that he can no longer do the job. Or, like in the case we have here, is when the prime minister feels that the coalition that he built will not allow him to proceed at the line that he's planning ahead. And he feels that an early elections will change the game or the field within the parliament to allow him to manage things better to his perspective.
So Netanyahu obviously feels like there's an advantage to calling the early elections. He thinks he'll end up with a stronger coalition or at least a different coalition that allow him to pursue whatever course he's trying to pursue. What course is he trying to pursue that his current coalition won't let him go with?
Ooh, that's a hard question because, you know, it's hard for me to get into
Netanyahu's mind. It's complicated, isn't it?
There are many topics on the table. One topic that Americans are very aware is the Iranian threat, the issues with Syria, all the security issues. But there are also two major other topics on the table. One is the ultra-Orthodox issue with drifting ultra-Orthodox men into the army.
Drafting the people who are going to yeshiva and don't sign up now.
Exactly, which is a huge issue in Israel. That's a huge issue. In the past, usually, that issue was an issue that will throw governments off of power.
Right.
The other issue is, of course, the economics. You know, just recently you had the debates here between Romney and Obama, and most of the things there were about economics, about well-being of the people.
Right.
That's kind of the same in Israel. A lot of people feel very stressed with economics. So those two issues, I think those two issues are driving him into the early elections and not the security part.
Thank you, Guy. That really clears it up. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, just back from Europe. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you just literally arrived. Tell us about this trip.
Well, it was a very interesting trip in many ways. The first stop was to participate in an international conference in Vienna at the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, where I used to work. The occasion of the conference was to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the creation of the Office of the Coordinator for Economic and Environmental Aspects of Security. I was the first person to occupy that office. So I met for the first time my successors, and I was blown away. The immediate successor, I'd never met any of them. The immediate successor is a former minister of foreign trade from Poland, who was also once the mayor of Warsaw. So he's a politician. The next guy was a former minister of education from Belgium, who's also a member of the Belgian nobility. Who knew there was such a thing, right?
Right.
He's a baron, and he's a professor at a Catholic university there. Very nice guy, very professorial, speaks French, was amazed that we could speak in French together. And the current occupant, who's only the fourth, was the former foreign minister of Serbia in Belgrade named Goran Svilanovic. Very nice guy. And he was also shocked that I could speak his language. So the Pole was a little bit offended because he was the one guy whose language I couldn't speak. But anyway, we talked about the growth of this organization and its awareness of different aspects of security and how, for example, they have an Office of Democratic Institutions and Human Rights, ironically located in Warsaw, which has now a sub-office and a whole active program on combating anti-Semitism in Europe because they're combating the new anti-Semitism. That didn't exist when I was there. And the office, which I used to run with two professionals and a half-time clerical person, now has 24 professionals and 12 full-time clerical people. So it has grown, and it was heartwarming to see. But then I began a trip with friends from Green Valley, actually, through the Balkans to several different Balkan cities. We started in Dubrovnik, which still has a little synagogue and a Jewish museum and a very old Jewish community. Dubrovnik, of course, for many centuries was part of the Venetian Empire, and it was not an unimportant part because it was a very major trading city.
It was a beautiful city, too.
It's absolutely gorgeous, and it's amazing to see that in what used to be the very low season, I mean, late October, nobody would go there between late October and late March, it's still crowded. Cruise ships, day trippers, charter flights full of elderly people from Sweden and Norway, where it's already winter. It was amazingly full, and even the synagogue and the Jewish museum seemed to be doing quite a bit of business because a lot of the cruise ship passengers are Jews from either Israel or North America or whatever. So that was kind of gratifying. But the really interesting part that I guess we'll have to talk about next week was Bosnia, which begins about 10 minutes drive outside of Dubrovnik. And this was fascinating and exciting, and I'm sure your listeners will be very interested.
We will look forward to that next week. Thanks, Tom. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two Jews, Morty and Saul, are out one afternoon on a lake when their boat starts sinking. Saul says to Morty, "Listen, Morty, you know I don't swim so well." Morty remembers how to carry another swimmer from his lifeguard class when he was a kid, and he begins tugging Saul towards the shore. But after about 10 minutes, he begins to tire. Finally, 100 feet from the shore, Morty asks Saul, "So, Saul, do you suppose you could float alone?" And Saul replies, "Morty, this is a hell of a time to ask me for money." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now, a word of Torah. This week, we read the Torah portion of Chaye Sarah, which marks a transition in the Genesis narrative from the tales of Abraham and Sarah, our first Jewish father and mother, to the next generation, featuring Isaac and Rebecca. But first, we begin with an ending. At the start of the portion, we're told of the length of Sarah's life, and almost by accident learn of Sarah's death. "The life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years," the Sedra begins, and a famous midrash on it tells us that Sarah was just as beautiful at the age of 100 as she was at 20, and just as free of sin at 20 as she had been at 7.
It's a fine encomium for a significant figure who now passes from the scene. Chai Sarah is also a portion filled with negotiations that have great influence on the future of the fledgling religion someday to be known as Judaism. The first extended section of Chai Sarah is actually dedicated to arranging for Sarah's funeral, which involves Abraham purchasing the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron, the first piece of real estate owned by our people in what will eventually be the land of Israel. That cave will become the burial place, not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and Leah. Eventually, all find their final resting place in Hebron. In Chaye Sarah, the purchase of this plot involves an extended bargaining session with the Hittite who owns it, and the payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish land in the world, establishing legitimacy in the Middle East at a very early point in history. I once visited Machpelah many years ago, back when it was safe to travel to Hebron. It's an interesting shrine, although not worth the potential danger to life and limb implicit in a trip to Palestinian Hebron these days. And then the narrative of Genesis moves us forward with one last important detail in Abraham's life. Abraham is old, and he sees that his son Isaac has not married, perhaps seems unlikely to do so without active parental intervention. Abraham charges his trusted servant to go back to the old country of Sumeria, today's Iraq, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry, to carry on the line of true believers in the one God. After a great journey in the first extended prayer passage in the whole Torah, the servant meets Rebecca drawing water from the city well in Haran. He knows that she is the one for Isaac because she shows generosity and great intelligence. The servant, too, bargains, in this case with Rebecca's duplicitous brother and father. Eventually, the servant arranges for her to become Isaac's wife. But at the crucial moment of the narrative, Rebecca's family puts the question to her. Will you go with this man? That is, will she leave all she has known and journey to an unknown land and future husband? This final negotiation of Chaye Sarah is brief. Rebecca agrees with alacrity to go along. Yes, she will leave the homeland and her father's house and go to the land that will be shown to her, like Abraham did. And so Rebecca goes and meets Isaac, and the future of the people and of monotheism is assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history: land, descendants, and destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have simply ceased to be. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rebecca and Abraham before her, our destiny would have been disappearance. As Jews, these remain our principal goals today, and often they still require negotiation to achieve: a secure homeland of Israel, our children and grandchildren's commitment to Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. When we come back on Two Jewish, our outstanding guest, former Israeli ambassador Itamar Rabinovich, will explain just what the Arab Spring and now winter really means for Israel and the Middle East and the world. Find out when we come back on Two Jewish in a moment.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
the massive storm system that raked the East Coast at the end of October brought unprecedented devastation to Jewish communities in and around New York City. Hurricane Sandy pushed 8-foot-high waves through the Brooklyn neighborhood of Manhattan Beach. In Seagate, on the western tip of Coney Island, entire homes collapsed, and an apartment building was evacuated after basement flooding led to explosions on the Upper East Side. Two Jews in their 20s were crushed by a tree in Ditmas Park, Brooklyn, and all of Lower Manhattan, including the Lower East Side, was without electricity for days. Jewish communal officials say it'll take weeks to measure the damage to community institutions. It's a disaster in every sense of the word, said David Pollack, Director of Security and Emergency Planning for the Jewish Community Relations Council of New York. Beachfront neighborhoods in South Brooklyn appear to have suffered the most dramatic damage. Seagate, a small gated community in Coney Island, surrounded on three sides by the Atlantic Ocean, is home to a few hundred Jewish families. Midday, back on October 30th, just hours after rising seas flooded the neighborhood, residents were struggling to describe what they had seen. Reza Lefkowitz, whose home was left standing, said that she was watching the waves with some of her five children at around 6:30 at night when the water started rising quickly. "We basically just ran away," she said. Standing in front of her home the next day, she said she could tell which houses the muddy piles of debris had floated away just by looking at the photos that were washing up on her lawn. In non-hurricane-related news, a Jewish agency committee has adopted a resolution calling for a satisfactory approach to prayer at the Western Wall, the Kotel in Jerusalem. The resolution, passed during the Jewish Agency for Israel's Board of Governors meeting last week in Tel Aviv, reads, "Jewish women and men of all streams of Judaism desire the opportunity to pray at the Western Wall of Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, in a manner that fulfills their religious expression and in an atmosphere of mutual respect and Ahavat Yisrael, love of Israel. It calls for the chairman of the executive of the Jewish Agency for Israel, consulting with the Committee for the Unity of the Jewish People, and working with Jewish Agency, Israel Government Coordinating Committees, and other appropriate bodies, including the Western Wall Heritage Foundation, to please arrive at a satisfactory approach to the issue of prayer at the Western Wall of Har HaBayit." The resolution comes in the wake of the arrest and roughing up by Israeli police earlier this month at the Western Wall of Anat Hoffman, leader of Women of the Wall and the Reform Movement's Israel Religious Action Center and a past guest of Too Jewish. Anat Hoffman was wearing a tallis and leading the Shema prayer at a Rosh Chodesh service for about 250 women at the time she was arrested. The Reform Movement has called for an Israeli police investigation into the incident. Hoffman says she was shackled, dragged across a jail floor, put into a cell overnight without a blanket, and had to use her tallis, her tallit, to cover herself. In 2003, Israel's Supreme Court ruled that women cannot wear a tallit or tefillin or chant from a Torah at the Western Wall. Last week was hardly the first time Israeli police stopped Anat Hoffman while she was leading a woman's prayer service at the wall. This time, however, they actually arrested her. The incident is galvanizing liberal Jewish groups in the U.S. and Israel. The Union for Reform Judaism, the URJ, called for a police investigation and expressed its dismay to Michael Oren, Israel's ambassador in Washington and another past guest of Too Jewish. In Israel, the Israel Religious Action Center, which Hoffman leads, launched a petition to the Supreme Court requesting that the Western Wall Heritage Foundation, which runs the holy site known as the Kotel, change its decision-making process and include non-Orthodox Jews. "There is no voice around that table for women, for paratroopers who liberated the wall, for the variety of pluralist voices," Hoffman said. "We want to dismantle this body. If the wall belongs to the Jewish people, where are the Reform, conservative, secular?" Her arrest during the Rosh Chodesh service on October 16th garnered more attention than previous incidents. Hadassah, which was holding its centennial celebrations in Jerusalem, sent some 200 women to pray with Hoffman, giving a big boost to the numbers of the service, which totaled about 250. After Hoffman was arrested, the incident received wide coverage in the American Jewish media. Condemnations of her arrest poured in from the Women's Rabbinic Network, the National Council for Jewish Women, and many others. Hadassah's national president, Marcy Natan, said, "Hadassah strongly supports the right of women to pray at the wall." In other news, Israel's intelligence services arrested dozens of Hamas terrorists in the West Bank who had been setting up infrastructure for the terrorist Islamic group there. In Hamas-controlled Gaza, terrorists fired volleys of rockets and mortars at southern Israel, triggering an Israeli airstrike. The Shin Bet says that 30 Hamas members were arrested near Ramallah, the West Bank's administrative center where they were setting up a Hamas network and relaying information to the overseas leaders of Hamas, which is sworn to Israel's destruction. They were also setting up Hamas cells in West Bank schools. Two of the people arrested were involved in the murder of the Israeli soldiers by a Palestinian mob, two of them in 2000. The two soldiers entered Ramallah by mistake at the time and were taken to a police station where they were tortured and then thrown out of a second-story window to their deaths. Hamas violently took over Gaza in 2007 in bloody street battles, defeating the rival Palestinian group Fatah. The Palestinian Authority, dominated by Fatah, has limited powers in the West Bank under Israel's overall security control, but it has also launched its own crackdown against Hamas. Iran has images of sensitive Israeli military bases taken by a drone that was launched by Lebanon's Hezbollah movement and downed by Israel earlier this month, a senior Iranian lawmaker claimed, in the latest boast from Tehran about purported advances in the capabilities of its unmanned drone aircraft. The announcement gave no details about the photos other than calling the Israeli bases forbidden sites, maybe Dimona, but it suggested Iranian drones have the ability to transmit data while in flight. It also appeared aimed at warning Israel about the options for retaliation for possible strikes on Iranian nuclear sites. Ismail Kosari, the prominent lawmaker and former head of the Revolutionary Guards, also said that the Iranian-backed Hezbollah possesses more sophisticated Iranian-made drones than the one that was downed, including some that might carry weapons. These drones transmit the pictures online, Kosari told the semi-official Mehr news agency. The pictures of forbidden sites in Israel, taken and transmitted by this drone, are now in our possession. Kosari, who heads the parliament's defense committee in Iran, said Hezbollah is definitely equipped with more sophisticated drones, but gave no details. Israeli military officials in Israel's northern command said they do not believe the drone possessed a camera, although they noted an Israeli investigation is continuing. Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah said that the drone was manufactured in Iran and assembled in Lebanon, probably by taking apart an American one and imitating it. Leaders of South Africa's ruling party last week declared their support for a boycott of Israel. Several anti-Israel declarations were made in Pretoria during the Third International Solidarity Conference organized by the African National Congress, the ANC. More than 1,000 delegates from South Africa and around the world participated in the conference held in Pretoria, commemorating the anti-apartheid struggle. During the debate, a German delegate opposed to the proposal endorsing a boycott of Israel said that Israel cannot be compared to the apartheid regime in South Africa. In response, the ANC chairperson and former deputy president of South Africa, Baleka Mbete, accused Israel of being worse than apartheid South Africa. The Tshwane Declaration, concluding the conference, called upon the delegates to condemn the continuous occupation of Palestinian territories by the Israeli government. It reiterated support for a Palestinian state within the 67 borders, East Jerusalem as its capital, and including full membership in the UN. It also expressed support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. Oh boy. Finally, in sports, David Stern's long, storied, and occasionally polarizing tenure as National Basketball Association commissioner will come to a close on February 1, 2014, exactly 30 years after he began to run the NBA. When the moment arrives, he will hand the reins to Adam Silver, his hand-picked heir, one Jew passing the ball to another, as it were. Not that that happens much in NBA games, but in running the league. During Stern's tenure, the NBA has grown from a marginal league, perpetually on the verge of bankruptcy, to a world-class sports franchise with truly international reach. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World.
We're delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our special guest this morning, former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Itamar Rabinovich, a renowned academic, member of the Trilateral Commission, and a very important figure both in Israel and abroad. If you were to characterize the most important foreign policy issues facing Israel today, how would you list them? We talked about Iran and the danger of Iran becoming nuclear, but that's certainly not the only foreign policy issue.
No, the I think hardly less important is our relationship with the Palestinians, the need to resolve that issue, or at least put it back on a healthier track than the current stalemate, because this is not a question that Israel can ignore. There is a demographic development on the way, and if time goes on and nothing happens, we may face a Palestinian majority west of the Jordan River, with the immense ramifications for the character of the state of Israel. So Israelis debate, this is the most hotly debated issue in Israeli politics, over how exactly to deal with this challenge, but it is a very important challenge. And then there is the challenge to Israel's security of what is known not very aptly as the Arab Spring, because spring has already
spring, transformed, winter, summer,
morphed,
fall.
Into a real winter. If you look at the massacres in Syria, at what goes on in Libya and Yemen and other places, but
Egypt for them.
Egypt, there is a turmoil and around us, and clearly there is an ascendance of Islamist forces. Islamist forces, by definition, do not recognize the legitimacy of Israel, because for an Islamist, territory that was once Islamic or Muslim has to be Muslim. We cannot recognize Christian or Jewish sovereignty over a territory that
was ever Islamic.
So the fact that Egypt, our most important neighbor, is now controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood, that in Syria the jihadi or Islamist forces are very active in the opposition, and so on and so forth, the fact that the relationship with Jordan is under threat because the king is under threat by domestic opposition, creates new national security challenges to Israel. So between Iran, the issue, the Palestinian issue, the debate inside Israel over the Palestinian issue, ramifications of the Arab Spring, let me add to that the international campaign to delegitimize Israel and destroy or to oppose the very notion of the legitimacy of Jewish sovereignty in our historic homeland, this is a full plate.
It's always a full plate with Israel, maybe a little bit more so, or maybe significantly more so now because of the changes. There was, after all, dictatorship around Israel, but stability. Was dictatorship preferable to the current Islamist trend in the more democratic Arab world?
Probably not in the long run. I said in the long run, our hope for stable relations with our neighbors is that they will have a healthier political life. You know, you use the term democracy. I think any hope for Western-style democracy in the Middle East anytime soon is a little messianic, because there's more to democracy, as we know, than free elections, and the ground is not ready for that. But I would say more democratic regimes, emphasis on participation. There clearly is, in what is known as the Arab Spring, there is a massive movement in the region of people who are tired of corrupt tyrannies and want more participation and more social justice. Hopefully, in 15, 20 years, this will breed healthier politics around us, but the question is how do you survive during the transitional period when the hope is shadowed or overshadowed by threats.
Israel's reputation abroad bounces. There was a long time, several years, in which it seemed that Israel's public relations was doing a very poor job of expressing its story to the world. Do you think that's improved, worsened? How would you characterize it?
I think we need to distinguish between, say, the machinery of public relations and the substance of the issues. So the machinery is not deteriorated. I don't think it has improved much. We have a prime minister who is a first-rate performer on...
speaks English better than most Americans.
And knows the trade of how to appear on television, how to speak to Congress. That he knows that very well, but You know, the turf wars between the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the IDF, and other involved parties continue. Every Israeli minister makes, or almost every Israeli minister makes statements, some of them not really called for. So you can invest a lot in building a case, and then some uncalled for statement by a senior minister can destroy years of effort. And the substance is difficult. Palestinian issue is controversial around the world, and even the Iranian issue. For us, it's a very serious issue. I don't use the term existential. I don't think it sends a good message, and I think that Israel can cope even with a nuclear Iran. It's not something we want to see. It's going to be a severe challenge, but it's not existential. But it is something we are determined to prevent, and I think rightly so. And we also think that the problem is not just ours; it's the whole world's. But if you live in Kansas, or if you live in
Arizona,
or yeah, or if you live in Poland, you don't look at it the same way. You need to be quite sophisticated to figure out what the nuclear Iran that may take charge of, or may take control of the rest of the Gulf and the oil, and may threaten Western Europe and even the United States with long-range missiles with nuclear warheads at the hands of mullahs, and may precipitate a nuclear arms race in the rest of the Middle East with other countries like Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia going nuclear. It's a huge menace to international security. But as I said, if you live in Arizona and you're not Jewish and you don't have a particular attitude to Israel or to the Middle East, you don't understand why the United States should act militarily or impose sanctions on Iran to prevent it. It's a bit too remote and too abstract for others to understand, to the same extent that people in the Middle East, not just us, the Saudis or Jordanians, understand it as well as we do.
You know, it's fascinating. I think for Jews, the centrality of Israel in our minds sometimes prevents us understanding that it's a small country in the Middle East, and to most people around the world, it isn't the most important place in the world, even though for us it still is.
On the one hand, it's not the most important, but it draws an immense interest. I'm always struck by the fact that when I travel in this country quite a bit, and you come to a place in Colorado, in the state of Washington, and you open a local newspaper, and we are on the front page. Yeah. So, and sometimes you wish that the world would have less interest.
Less attention. I want to thank Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich for a great visit here on Two Jewish, and a siyah tova, a safe trip home. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Two Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be the Jewish comedian. Wait, that's redundant. I mean, aren't all comedians Jewish? Jewish comedian Joel Chasnoff with us next week. Our playout this morning is the classic Yemenite Shabbat song, Dror Yikra. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.